The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Turn to chapter 12, sentence 1. What we focused on yesterday was an apparent evasion of the text to give us any appreciation for the character references of Abraham. As very disturbing, being that this is the beginning of what's called the chosen people, that the chosen people notion doesn't have much foundation. That some man was with his father and he has this wife and she's barren and they're walking and that was it. And out of nowhere, without any mention, there is this explosive interruption of the divine into this human being's life and calls upon this human being to do something very radical. And we cannot understand what was the merit upon which this call was based. We offered the oral tradition that tells us that Abraham was a great philosopher, a spiritual giant, a genius, an activist. I mean, these are all wonderful. But since the written tradition doesn't mention anything about that, we can't understand then what was he chosen because of what was he chosen for. In addition, we notice that in contrast to the principal character of the last chapter in this, the chapter of human history, Noah, we're told, is a righteous man, right? Walks with God, and all that, you know, would make sense. And then God said to him, well, I'm going to destroy the world and you're going to live. But over here, there's no mention of being righteous, no mention of walking with God. So then we really have a very serious question upon the text, which then can help us really appreciate something very deep that the text is trying to teach us. The Torah, in what it says and what it doesn't say, equally teaches us. And therefore, to understand it, we have to really explore the text carefully. So let's look at it again. V'yomer Hashem el Avram. God says to Avram, Lech lecha, go. Mi'artzecha, from your land, u'mimoledetcha, from your birthplace, u'mibeit avicha, from your father's home, hela'aretz asher erech, to the land that I will show you. Ve'asecha l'goy gadol, here comes all these promises, I'll make you into a great nation. V'avarechecha, I will bless you, which means children, the oral tradition tells us, and money. V'gad l'shemecha, I will make you famous. V'ahave bracha, to you will be blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and those who curse you, I shall curse. And through you shall be blessed all the families of the earth. Wow, I mean, this is heavy. Right? This fellow is asked to do something, and what a promise! I mean, we're talking about, you know, the biggest, let's make a deal in history, you know? And what do we have for you behind door number one? I mean, this is really unbelievable. We're talking about incredible personal gratification and growth and wealth and fame and significance in a historical way. The entire earth will be blessed through you. You are a conduit for divine blessing to be brought into the world. And it says, V'yelech Avram, and Avram went kasher diber lav Hashem, just as God had spoken to him. And Lot went with him. And that's it. I mean, what's so incredible about Abraham? Upon what does he merit this calling? Any ideas? Yeah?
Perhaps if God had picked someone who had a much greater reputation or talents or abilities, you know, it would not have been that it was God that was doing this and determining, directing it. that it was more had to do with the individual, the person. And by choosing Abraham, just, you know, someone out of nowhere for no reason, doesn't say that there's any reason, perhaps then it is more that it's God doing it.
Okay. That's an interesting point, which follows the line of thought which deals with the question of the meaning of divine chosenness. Because when you talk about the idea of choosing, then choosing is within a limited context. Because choosing means I'm choosing between this book or that book, right? Which has meaning within the context of a human being. But when you talk about God choosing, that doesn't make any sense. Because choosing generally means a selection from a limited amount of choice. But to say that in relation to the divine doesn't make any sense, because the divine is unlimited. So the truth is, in Judaism, divine choice is a creation. Right? Divine choice isn't a selection from a group of limited, well, I need one of these, no, he's the best. I'll take him. But when we talk about divine choice in Judaism, it's actually a creation. When God chooses, what it means in relation to God is not the same what it means in relation to the human being. It means that God establishes a certain truth. But even so, right, there must be something about Abraham that helps us understand, so what is happening over here? So now what is happening over here? Yeah?
Well, if we're to accept the medrash about Abraham breaking the idols that you told us yesterday, that means that, as opposed to in the case of Noah, when God came to Noah, we know from this that Abraham came to God, that he decided on his own that there was an existence of just one God, and he demonstrated it, and he showed great courage in doing so.
So, but without the midrash, that's what we're working on. From whatever is written in the Bible, we must assume it's sufficient for us to say, wow, that's Abraham. Wow, that's the beginning of what it means to be Jewish. And we don't really seem to see much, right? Except for the fact that God says go, and says I'm going to give you a great prize, and he goes. Yeah.
It just occurred to me that that God's saying, you know, go away from your land, go away from where you're born, go from away from your where, you know, you live with your father. And it's like, you know, do this, do this, do this, which, and they're pretty heavy dudes. And it seems to me that God wouldn't say that to someone that wouldn't, that he already knew, would, you know, wouldn't be able to grasp that or follow through with it.
Mm-hmm.
So that maybe you, just by seeing what God said to Abraham, we know why he chose Abraham, because Abraham would have the ability to understand and unconditionally do something.
But that's too hinted. I mean, it doesn't make me personally feel comfortable that based on a hint over here, my entire Jewish identity, right? I mean, what you're saying is true, but we need something stronger in order to appreciate what it means to be Jewish. And why is it that this call is being addressed to Abraham? Now the truth is we're really playing on the assumption. The assumption is that God said this only to Abraham. How do we know? How do we know there were not thousands of people who heard the call of God that said, Lech Lecha? We don't know. We don't know.
And then he was the only one that answered.
Right. All we need to know about Abraham is he said yes. Right. And that's enough for us to appreciate the essence of what it means to be Jewish. Because all we need to know about Abraham is his ability to respond. His incredible sense of responsibility. He heard the call of God, go, and Abraham said yes. Abraham, when he said yes, he became the first Jew. His chosenness is not based on some kind of reference of the past. His chosenness is not based on the past. His chosenness is based on his choice of who he would become in the future. So it's not who Abraham was in the past, but who he chose to become in the future. Very crucial to appreciate what it means to be Jewish. See, if the Torah would have given us all kinds of personal reference, we'll say, okay, that's his character, that's who he is, and therefore that's what it means. But no. His chosenness is not based on the past. His chosenness is based on who he chose to become in the future. His chosenness is because he chose God. God chose Abraham, and his chosenness was actualized when Abraham chose God. But is that really very strong? I mean, what's so great about Abraham choosing God? I mean, if you were sitting there one day, you feel without a shadow of doubt that you've just heard this voice that says to you, go. Right? Go. And I will make you rich, famous, the head of state. The entire world would be blessed. I mean, wouldn't you go? I mean, what's so great? I mean, oh, big deal. Oh, he chose to go. What's so great? I mean, isn't this a holy bribe? I mean, it sounds like a bribe. Wouldn't it sound better if God says, go? That's all I'm saying. Abraham, go. And Abraham says, okay. All right, I'll go. But if you say go, and I'm going to give you X, Y, Z, I mean, why shouldn't he go? So this is very disturbing over here. Why do we have all these promises? And right after the promise, it says that Abraham went. And why wouldn't he go? So what's so great about Abraham? Yeah, wonderful, he responded to the call of God. But wouldn't anybody respond to the call of God when you've got all these promises? Yeah.
Okay, in the Hebrew and in the English both, it's punctuated in a way that these promises are grammatically separated from the commandment to leave. After the, I guess, the semicolon, it says, that's the first promise I will make of you a great nation. But up to that point, the clarity sentence is like, get out of the country, leave your brothers, don't leave the place of your generations. So there really is a space, a separation.
But even so, Abraham knows this before he goes.
But on the other hand, it's also irrelevant. I mean, all God might be sharing is the fact that, you know, this is your destiny. This is what the future is going to be. I'm just letting you in on it, regardless of whether you try to... I mean...
But it minimizes Abraham's greatness of purely responding to the call of God. When what kind of response is this? If someone says to you, I'm going to give you something, you know, if you do this. So you do it. I mean, the President of the United States says, I'll make you the Vice President. So certainly if God says, I'm going to put you in this great position. So why wouldn't he go? Why wouldn't anybody go? I mean, what's so great about Abraham, you know, to say, okay, I'll go. Right. So if you look at the Psukim carefully, did Abraham go because of those promises or not? Did he go because of those promises or not? Look at the verses themselves. They'll teach you something very, very important. Because the Bible is written with such precision. There's something extra that it says in the verse. What is extra in the verse?
I will bless you and make you great.
No, that's not extra. I mean, that's... When we explain it, you'll see it's not repetitive at all. We'll just explain that in a second. Ah, excellent. It says, and Abram went just as God told him. Now, why do I have to say that? All we have here is God spoke to Abram and said, go from your land and I'll make you a great nation. The next statement should say, and Abram went. And obviously, why does it say Abram went just as God told him? And also, I want you to notice the different word in Hebrew. Because the word that expresses the conversation between the divine and Abraham was V'yomer Hashem, right? And over here it says, and Abraham went kasher diber alav Hashem. There's a difference between amar and diber. Amar is a wish. I want you, I ask you to go. Diber is a commandment, right? And Abraham said, your wish is my command. Why did Abraham go? Because God told him to go. That's the only reason he went. Why did God give him all these promises? Most probably that's part of his test. Because Abraham succeeded in overcoming the motivation to go in order to have and went in order to be in a relationship with God. That's the first Jew. That is a Jewish identity. A Jewish identity is a human being who bases their life on what they understand to be the will of the Supreme Being. And they do it not in order to have, but in order to be. In fact, this is a great act of love. There is a saying in Jewish ethics, don't serve the master in order to get a prize, but serve the master in order not to get a prize. Now, what does that mean? I mean, generally it's understood, love God, right? You know, that service should be out of love. So then why doesn't it just say that? Why doesn't we just say, serve God out of love? Why does it have to be so specific? Don't serve the master in order to get a prize. I mean, why don't they just serve God out of love? Because there's two ways of interpreting love. One an authentic way and one a counterfeit way. See, sometimes love is having. Right? I love this person, why? Because the things they give me. Right? The things that I will have, but is that really love? Is that loving the person? No, it's loving yourself. That person is just a means to my own self-fulfillment. I don't love them, I love myself, and they are instrumental in my own self-fulfillment. So loving in order to have is unfortunately a predominant phenomena, certainly in our days, that people are under this kind of consumer consciousness. And just like the way people go about trying to buy a car, you know, what do I get out of it? Right? What does it do for me? So too people date. You know, I want to have a girl who has these qualities. Right? I want to have a guy who has these qualities. A relationship is not having, it's being. Having is just an experience between me and myself. And the person is just another thing amongst all the other things you want to have. But a relationship is an experience of being. And so over here God says, and this is what I'm going to give you. And Abraham did it because God asked him to do it. It was a pure response. A pure relationship for no other reason than the relationship itself. You ask me to do it, I'll do it. That's love. That's really love. What do I get out of this? That's not love. Well, I'll do it. Just tell me what I get out of it. That's not love. So here we have an incredible human being because we have this person who bases his life choices on his relationship with what he understands of a supreme being beyond himself. But now let's go a little deeper. Because what is God actually asking Abraham to do? What really is this act? What is he doing? Is he just going to some city? Now notice what he does. First of all, notice. And Abram went, just as God told him, and Lot went with him. And Abraham was 75 years old. Now, why does the verse have to tell me this? Here, and Abram went, Lot went with him, and Abram 75 years old. I mean, you could have told me before when you gave me his character history, right? Abram was 75 years old. Why over here? It doesn't seem to be in the proper place. Do you see that? That it seems a little strange that at this verse it would say, and he's 75 years old. Lot went with him, and Abraham is 75 years old. Right? It's telling us something that's crucial for understanding of Abraham. It's not simply telling us his age, but at this point telling us his age makes a whole difference in what we just saw happen. Because we're not talking about a spring chicken. Right? We're not talking about a youthful, adventurous person, you know, a hippie who doesn't mind moving and wandering. We're talking about a very established human being, 75 years old.
But age then didn't have the same meaning as it does now. I mean,
75 years old still does. I mean, you have to understand that maybe for them, 75 years old is like for you, 40 years old. 40 years old is still midlife. Right? We're talking still midlife. And that's a very crucial time. But notice, what does he do? And Abraham gets up and he takes his wife and Lot and their property and all the souls that they had made in Haran and they go. Now, isn't that amazing? I mean, what would you do Right. I mean, you're willing to respond. You hear this call. You say you should do it. Go to this land that I will show you. What would you do? You'd say, well, Sarah, you stay here with the camp. Right? I got this call. I got to check it out. When I set up things, I'll send back word for you to join me. I'll go on a pilot trip to Israel. You know, nobody moves to Israel like that. All right, what you do is you take off 2 weeks from your job, you go, and you check out what kind of business opportunities are available. You write back, you say, it looks good, you know, and we'll move there in 10 years. Right? But you don't, can you imagine this? One day you buy an LL ticket, you sell all your property, and you get on a plane, and you say, here we are. That's amazing. I mean, this is a very unusual person, right? Who is willing to respond completely to the will of God. Now, no one is suggesting that we are on that level or that level is expected of us. But in order to be the root, the founding father and mother of such a people, this is what he has to do. So don't get nervous and say, oh man, is that what I have to do as a Jew? Well, you know, we're human and we're not at that level. But to be the founding father, we'd like to see what is it about this person that really inspires us in our own path. And based on such a personality, we have a certain commitment to an evolving message and mission that we have in life. Well, this is an unusual person. A person whose life is based on a relationship with God. Pure responsibility. He believes he's heard the call of a supreme being, and he is willing 1,000,000% to respond for only the sake of responding to the will and nothing else. But what really is God asking him? God simply asking him to go to move to Eretz Yisrael and buy a villa in Herzliya? I mean, what really is God asking Abraham? Well, let's look at it very carefully. Because there's something a little difficult in the first sentence. Leave your country, your birthplace, and your father's home to a land that I will show you. First of all, he was not told where he's going. He doesn't know where he's going. Can you imagine that? You don't even know where you're going. That's okay. Right.
Why doesn't it just say go from where you are?
Go from where you are. But there's something more difficult over here, not only in terms of the amount of things that are said, but the way it was said. There's something strange about this sentence. Unless you see it, you can't appreciate what he was really asked to do. Something's problematic with this verse. The verse is written in a manner that you would not have written it. What is strange about this verse? Yes.
You would have said, in general, just leave the country. That would have implied leaving your father's.
Okay, good point. Good point. In other words, one, it seems redundant if you leave your country, but not really, because leave your father's home might mean, you know, I'll leave my country and take the whole household with me. Which itself is a bit of a problem why he took Lot, which was part of his father's household, which is something that he's going to have to work out, right? But the truth is, we could still get away with saying, well, the father's house could still be in there because maybe he'd bring the household with him. And they were traveling before anyways. Right? The household was in movement, if you read before. So he already had been in a process of movement in the first place. Any other ideas of what's difficult? See, it's in the wrong order. Geographically, it's in the wrong order. First, you leave your father's house. And then as you're leaving, you end up leaving the city limits. And then as you're leaving, you leave the country's limits. And this is in the wrong order. Do you see that? It's in the wrong order. It would make more sense to say, leave your father's home, leave your city, and leave your country, and go to a place that I will show you. But it must be in the right order. So it's not in the order of geographical leaving. What's it in the order of? Ideas?
Maybe how hard it is to leave.
Psychological. Psychologically, it's tough to leave your country. It's even tougher to leave the place you were born, right? There's a certain organic connection you feel to the place you were born. Right? People feel that. And then it becomes even more psychologically difficult to leave your father's home. Why are these psychologically difficult? What's so difficult about leaving all these three things? Country, birthplace, father's home.
Leaving your identity.
Leaving your identity. Because these are the foundations of your identity. These are the foundations, these are the fundamental ingredients of a human being's identity. And more so, it is from these places that one gains the sense of security. is from these places that I gain a certain confirmation of self. And now it's really ironic because God didn't say, go. God said, lech lecha, which literally means what?
Be out.
No, it doesn't. Lech lecha means go to yourself. And therefore this verse is paradoxical. Go to yourself by leaving yourself. I mean, these are the foundations of people's sense of self. What is Abraham being asked to do? What is Abraham being asked to do? And what did he do? Abraham is being asked to let go of all those conditions that formulate most people's sense of self for a new sense of self, which is a function of a relationship with God. And I will make you a great nation. Generally, how do people become great nations? Well, you stick around in your country, you get involved, you have a certain amount of schlep and protexia, and as certain things go on, you take control of the country, perhaps, and you for a great nation. Who became a nation in exile? Off their land. That's us. The Jewish people were first referred to as a nation in Egypt in exile. And I will make your name great. I mean, it's really unbelievable. It's amazing. Because this is a transformation. Abraham is transforming into a whole new kind of human being. Because most people's identity is a function of their relationship to their country, to their city, their citizenship, right? Their property rights based on the cities they live in, and their certain inheritance rights based on their family and their connection to their family. Most people's identity is founded upon these three elements. And yet Abraham is being asked to accept a sense of I, which is a function of a relationship with an eternal thou, independent of nationalism, independent of property, and independent of his personal history. Identity, which is a function of right here, right now, my relationship to a supreme being. It's unbelievable. But this is the secret of Jewish survival. Because if your identity is a function of your country, what will happen when you're thrown out of your country? That's the end of your identity. If your identity is based on your property rights in your city, what happens when they're confiscating all your property? They throw you out. There goes your identity. And what happens if you have been severed from your family, scattered all over the earth? What will happen to your identity? It's gone. And that's the secret of Jewish survival. Because a Jew's identity is a function of a relationship with God, which exists no matter where you are, no matter what situation you're in. The survival of the Jewish people has fascinated many. And I'd like to share with you a few sources, which you might have heard already. This is from Leo Tolstoy. What is this Jew? What is this Jew? This is not at all as strange a question as it would first appear to be. Come, let us contemplate what kind of unique creature is this, whom all the rulers and all the nations of the world have disgraced and crushed, expelled and destroyed, persecuted, burned and drowned, and to despite their anger and their fury, continues to live and flourish. What is this Jew? Whom they have never succeeded in enticing with all the enticements in the world, whose oppressors and persecutors only suggested that he deny his religion and cast aside the faithfulness of his ancestors. The Jew is the symbol of eternity. He is the one whom they were never able to destroy. Neither bloodbath nor afflictions, neither the fire nor the sword of the Inquisition succeeded in annihilating them. He is the one who for so long has guarded the prophetic message, transmitted it to all mankind. A people such as this can never disappear. The Jew is eternal. He is the embodiment of eternity. It's very heavy, which we'll explain in a second. Mark Twain. The Egyptians, Babylonians, and Persians rose up and filled the world with extravagant glory and splendor, until this splendor was dimmed, and they sank and ultimately perished. The Greeks and the Romans followed in their footsteps, made a loud noise, and then disappeared. Other nations appeared and held their torch high for a while, but it was burned in its own fire, and now they sit in the shadow, or have altogether vanquished, vanished. The Jew has seen them all, beat them all, and he is today what he was then. He does not show signs of becoming submerged, nor the weariness of old age. His aptitude has not slowed down, his awareness is as keen as ever. Everyone is mortal in this world, except the Jew. All the powers of history pass away, but the Jew remains. What is the secret of his eternity? Lech Lecha is the secret of his eternity. Because a Jewish identity is founded upon a relationship with God. I mean, did anyone hear of the Babylonians? You know, the big Babylonians. And when you read world history, it's amazing. This is a world power, superpowers. It's like Russia and United States today. Could you imagine someone in like 100 years from now saying, United States? What's that? Oh, that little place over there? I mean, we have to realize, somehow kind of imagine and sensitize ourselves to how these were superpowers in world history and nobody's heard of them. The Persians. Remember the Persian Empire? You know? It's unbelievable when you think of it. And yet the small population of Jews, right, who've been thrown out of their land. You take the Romans, you throw them out of Rome. They're no longer Romans. Right? They're United States citizens, right? But they're not Romans. You throw the Persians out of their land. You cut their ties with their families. They're no longer Persians. The amazing thing about the Jewish people is they still survive. Why? Because Jewish identity is a function of a relationship with God. And to take it a step further, on a bit of a more metaphysical note, all identity is a function of relationship. They're finding more and more today that there is no such thing as an isolated reality. A carbon atom has a completely different identity when it's relating to different types of atoms. A carbon atom could be part of a diamond, could be part of carbon dioxide. Relationship determines your definition. There's a Hasidic saying that says, if I am I because you are you, and you are you because I am I, then I am not I and you are not you. Now generally people understand it to mean, do your own thing. Right? Don't be dependent. But that's not its meaning. Its meaning is stating a fact. I am I because you are you. And you are you because I am I. We are interdefined. We are not isolated islands. But our own definition is a function of our relationship to the whole. And so included in my definition is you, and included in your definition is me. So if I am I because you are you, and that's a fact, you are included in my own definition, and you are you because I am included in your definition, then I am not I, and you are not you. There is no separation, although there is distinction. Now you take that a step forward. If your identity is a function of a relationship with God, if your identity is a function of a relationship with an eternal you, that means included in your I, in the definition of your I, is eternity. And therefore the Jew is the embodiment of eternity. Because included in the Jew's human I is a divine you, which gives the Jew an aspect of eternity in their own personal definition. To a certain extent, what is a Jew? A Jew is a human eye defined by a relationship to an eternal thou. A Jew is a human eye to the inclusion of a divine, eternal you. And therefore, the Jewish people will survive no matter what. Because Jewish identity is an identity which is a function of a relationship with God. Whether Jews know that or not, whether Jews want to accept that or not, and whether the Jews choose to relate to God, God is still relating to the Jews, and history testifies to that. History testifies to that. That beyond all odds, we have transcended natural history. If the Jewish people were to rely on natural conditions for their survival, they should have disappeared long ago. Long ago. We are a puzzle in the philosophy and mechanics of world history. Because the Jewish history is God history. So we have just seen a human being transform from an I based on my country, my city, my family, to an I based on a relationship with God. From an I based on what I have in terms of what I get from my country, what I get from my city, and what I get from my family, to an I based on who I am in a relationship with God. Now this is a crucial, crucial thing in our world today, because most people's identity is based on what they have. And today, what is called security is money. And money is the most insecure way of having a sense of self-esteem. Because the more money you have, the more money you have to lose. When people base their identity on what they have, then they have built an identity on the most insecure foundation. And when the stock market crashed, plenty of people jumped out their windows. Because they crashed, not their money. They crashed. But when a person understands that my identity is based on who I am, and who I am is based on the relationships I establish in my life, then you can never take that away from me. And the Jew was always based on who are you, not what do you have. What do? Not what do you have. So I remember I was when I was in the States raising money to keep this thing alive. So I had a meeting with an extremely rich man. And he invited me to very luxurious, expensive office, and one of the most expensive office buildings in the city. And I walk in, and I look, and I say, wow, look at this, right? Phew. And I go into his office, he's got antique, I mean, it's not like office furniture, we're talking about antiques, right? And he's wearing at least $1,000 suit, right? Very distinguished looking man, fantastic view, right? Says, please, Rabbi, sit down, Now tell me what exactly is it that you do, you know. So I sit down and I says, oh, before we start, would you like a cup of coffee? I said, well, thank you. So he says, fine, and he just reaches underneath his seat and taps something. And this very attractive secretary walks in from pushing his little hidden button. And she says, oh, yes, sir, what can I do for you? Two coffees, please. Oh, fine, yes. She comes back with two coffees. She then says, sir, two teaspoons of sugar or one? Says, one, please. Sir, how much coffee would you like, sir? A thimbleful, please. Oh, yes, sir. Shall I stir it for you, sir? I'm not exaggerating. He says, yes, thank you. And she stirs his coffee. Now she looks at me. how much sugar? It's okay, I can do it myself. Shall I stir it for you? I said, no, it's okay, thanks. I can stir it myself. So we're talking, and I'm telling him about what I'm doing here and why it's so important to have this kind of an institute, you know, serving Jewish education. I give him the whole song and dance. So he looks at me and he says, Rabbi, you have to understand. I live daily with the insecurity that I might lose this all tomorrow. Can you imagine that? I thought, oh boy. Right? So there's just so much I could give you right now. Right. You see, we don't believe a rich person is a person who has a lot. We believe a rich person is a person who can give a lot. Because a person who can give a lot knew that they never had anything in the first place. It was all coming through God. They knew that whatever they are is because of their relationship with God, and whatever they could be is because of their relationship with God. And their money is only important in terms of how they could express that relationship. A person who knows how to give a lot receives even more. But this man lives with incredible insecurity. I have more security in my life than he does. And I'm generally in debt, right? And he, right? In Israel, you learn to be in debt, you learn to rely on God. Right? My father-in-law is probably the holiest banker in Israel. Right? He works in a bank. He's one of the managers. And these people come in daily to know if they got another penny. Right? And they argue that they got it back and it doesn't make sense because there's an agurah missing. And my father-in-law looks at him and says, why don't you go learn some Torah? Why do you spend 2 hours waiting in line to talk about this? Right? And people come in with their bills and he looks at him and says, it's in the hands of Hashem. You know, you'll just have to just believe in Hashem. He's probably the holiest banker I know. Holiest banker I know. He tells people that your investments are in the wrong place. Invest in God. Right? Invest in God. That's what they say. Jesus saves. Moses invests. Right? You got to invest in your relationship with God. Right? And so, people today, their identity is based on air. Right? And everything that is called securities today should be called insecurities. The only thing that you can rely on is your relationships. Your identity is a function of your relationships. And you are your relationships. And if you have a relationship with an eternal thou, then included in your own identity is eternity. Jewish people, individuals, aren't necessarily eternal. But the Jewish people, Jewish nation, Jewish identity will never die. Right? Only individuals who don't want to be part of that. Right? So this is the first Jew. It's not based on being some great philosopher. It's not great. You know, we don't see Abraham sitting on some mountain meditating. We don't see Abraham sitting in some study hall working over some brilliant philosophical test or text or some legalistic text. That's not what we see. We see a person who is willing to go in response to a call, accepting an identity, a function of that relationship. And I will make you a great nation. You'll become a great nation, but not based on any natural conditions. It doesn't say, and if you go, then you will become a great nation. The Midrash points out clearly, it says, and I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will restore to you everything that you let go of. But in order to be the root of this unique identity called Jewish, and the role that the Jew has, and the responsibility the Jew has to the rest of the world, that Abram had to do. That Abram had to do. And he transcended his personal identity based on what he has. And his personal identity may be even based on his relationships in terms of who he is, in terms of his relationship to his country, his relationship to his city, his relationship to his parents. He, in terms of who he had to be, had to let go of all of that in order to become a human eye to the inclusion of a divine thou. And that is the secret of Jewish survival. The Jewish people have been off their land for more time than they've been on their land. We've just finished 2,000 years of exile. And there are people who've been on their land much longer than we've been on our land, who have lost their identity long time ago. The Jewish people are a miracle. They are no less than a miracle. And the Jewish people represent God in this world as an agent representing a big boss in the real estate deals, right? Representatives, right? They remind the world of what is true identity, what is true survival, right? People think to survive means I've got to hoard a lot of money, right? And a lot of those people did not survive. The Jews have survived with nothing, without a country, without money, without family support, because we have been scattered and there are brothers and sisters who have still yet to meet each other after maybe 50 years and hope maybe one day they will, through the help of Yad Vashem, maybe reconnect with a lost brother that they last saw as they were making the selection, and maybe they're still alive. Without the support of a family, and yet the Jew still survives, right? Everybody wants to survive, right? But very few people know the secret of survival. And most people invest in everything that is contradictory to real human survival. Because the only thing worth investing in to survive is relationships between myself and my fellow man, and myself and the supreme reality, which we'll call God. That's the power of the Jewish people, and that's what happened to Abraham. Any questions on this that we've developed so far? Yeah.
Okay, how you're just saying now about Jewish people surviving in the relationship with God, but how does that come and take into account? It seems like there's only a small percentage now, and I mean, let's say over the last couple hundred years, of Jewish people who I think have that relationship. It seems like most...
Well, as I said, once Abraham has established this identity, which is a function of a relationship with God, if you get it, you get it. Whether you choose to live with it, right? As an individual, you might not survive, right? But as a people, the people still will survive, number one. Number two, once Abraham has effectualized that kind of relationship between himself and the divine and that kind of personal definition, whether the Jew chooses to relate to God or not, God is relating to them, because that's part of the deal. That's part of the deal. So you're right, there are lots of Jews who don't know anything about Judaism. True. But as worried as we might feel, this period of history is, I don't know if it's so much more threatening than any other period of Jewish history. Because if you look through Jewish history, there were Jews that were doing mummish idol worship. I mean, I'm talking about really disgusting things. Right? We're talking about just in the Bible, after the first encounter with God, they've got golden cows. And I mean, you know, so the struggle of the Jewish people in being true to their identity, that we will develop in a very deep way in the future. Right? But what's happening in our day is not so completely new than what has ever happened. And that's part of the dynamics of a relationship as you try to maintain your sense of, well, who am I in the face of this God? And it's a pretty involved discussion in terms of what makes a human being a human being, what makes my personal identity identity, what's the struggle between individuality and universalism and things like that, which we're going to be opening up. We're going to really be opening up. So, true. But on the other hand, I have to tell you that I am overwhelmed to see how many Jews are interested in their identity once again. All right. And how I've met people who, I mean, didn't know anything about Judaism except something about their parents maybe having something on the door. And they feeling somehow uprooted from some original source, and they search and they end up in Jerusalem as they try to understand, who am I anyways? So it's very, very powerful that whether the identity is dormant or not, it's not gone, it's just sleeping. in some people's life. And many, many Jews try to escape their identity. But generally, at those periods of time when the Jews escaped their identity, precisely in that time that there was this incredible new, revised edition of anti-Semitism, right? And whether the Jew wants to be Jewish or not, we seem to be forced back into recognizing we're Jews. And I hate using anti-Semitism as a way to encourage Jews to be Jewish. Right? We should have the opportunity to explore being Jewish from inside rather than as a victim from outside. Yeah.
I can understand finding myself through a relationship with something eternal, like, you know, Hashem. But you're saying that a person is really, a person's best defined by the relationships in which they engage. But we all know that
relationship. Not best defined, that's your real definition.
All right, so that's your real definition. Then all the more so, people get divorced, people die, you're involved with the girl and it doesn't work out, you're involved with the boyfriend and it turns out to be, bad news. I mean, these are all the relationships which, if these define us and they're ephemeral, I mean, what kind of stable definition is that of ourselves?
Well, in terms of a stable definition, you're right, because a relationship with a human being is not completely stable. Here today, gone tomorrow. The only ultimate stable relationship is one that one has with a supreme being, God. Because the relationship that goes beyond this physical world, right, it goes into even after death. Right? That's why a very high level person would not be afraid of death, because they know there is no death. Right? Because my identity is a function of relationship, and that relation will not be severed once my body's gone. Right? True. But just getting back to, so what about when you break up? Well, that's part of defining you, which is, sometimes breakup in relationships contribute to new understandings and even better relationships in the future. So, it all boils down to the kinds of relationship you develop and whether that relationship breaks down. The breakdown itself is very clarifying in terms of directing you in terms of the kind of relationship you really could create. So, even breakdowns are part of the building in our lives. Yeah?
Where's the separation between, the cutoff point between God's relationship with the Jew versus the non-Jew?
There is no cutoff point.
A non-Jew can come through, his identity through God just the way, same, strength as a Jew can. So, what's difference in the nation as a whole, the covenant with the nation as a whole?
Well, as individuals, the non-Jews can do it. At a national level, they can't. In other words, Abraham is not the beginning of a bunch of individuals. That you didn't need Abraham for, because there were lots of people in his time that were holy people and were people who had God consciousness. And that we will see in the upcoming stories, that there was a priest. There was actually a priest at the time who was a priest of the Most High God, it says. So there were individuals. Holy individuals is not what Torah came to bring into the world, right? Torah came to bring into the world a phenomenon called a holy nation, to inspire other nations to realize that at the national level, your identity is a function of relationship with God. That's something that not everybody understands. Christianity will say, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and give to God what is God. Meaning the national level is independent of a responsibility to a supreme being, right? And that's why we have so much war in this world. Because the national level is completely independent of any responsibility to anything beyond the nation. Right? The nation becomes God. Individuals, no, you want a God, you want a religion, you want to eat a little kosher, that's one thing. But the strength and the power of the Jewish people is in peoplehood, in nationhood. See, a lot of people come to Judaism because they're looking for themselves. And they want some kind of psychological guidance in terms of who am I. And they get involved with Judaism because they feel that it does that for them. And then they start reading Dale Carnegie. And they say, well, Dale Carnegie could do the same thing for me. So why do I need this religion for? In terms of being a holy individual, right, you don't really need the Torah. Right? There are other ways to become a holy individual. But insofar as you are not any individual, you are an individual which is part of a nation. To the extent that you are connected to the nation, to that extent, you have discovered your full identity. Right? So Judaism in the Torah is dealing with how I become a Jew, right? How I become a good human being starts before the Torah. It says Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah. You know, being just a generally good human being, right? That you should kind of be aware of before you get the Torah. But Torah takes us a step further, which helps us as individuals plug into the community that I belong to, which is the ultimate source of true meaning. Because an individual doesn't feel any meaning unless they plug into the greater context that they belong to. So you have to understand that Torah is dealing with a national holiness, where the individual gains an additional sense of holiness because the individual is part of a nation. So, in terms of individuals, there are a lot of very holy individuals. And I think it's really terrible if any Jew would say, oh, you know, this guru, he's a fake. And all gurus must be fake. Or anybody not Jewish who's got a spiritual, ethical path, not true. Not true at all. Right? There are some incredibly beautiful, unbelievable spiritual leaders in the world. Right, but leaders as individuals. Right? The goal of the Jewish people is to be a chosen nation, a holy nation. To clarify that, the relationship between man and God is not only on the individual level, and the responsibilities derivative of that relationship don't only exist at the at the individual level, but economics, agriculture, right? International policies, all are determined by Torah. The king, he had this little Torah that was bound to his arm like a kameo. It was the entire Torah that was bound to his arm, and wherever he went, whether it was war, whether it was into some kind of, convening of the summit sessions or whatever it was, he looked at the Torah, and the Torah gave him guidance as a king. So the Torah is bound up with a national vision. And when Jews think that, oh, I'm Jewish, right? And they don't understand that to build Eretz Yisrael and to build our nation, the Jewish people, is part of, actually more than part of, it's the very ground upon which Judaism is based, then they're missing what Judaism came for. Judaism didn't come to be another religion amongst the other religions. Judaism came to direct individuals into a community called a nation and to demonstrate holiness on the national level with the various kinds of responsibility that a nation has to deal with, like sewage. Right? And like cleaning streets. And that's what it means to live. Judaism is for this world. It's not how do you get to the next world. It's how do you create this world. How do you sanctify God's name in this world? Right? And all the various responsibilities that it means in creating this world. So as individuals, where does it stop? It doesn't stop. But on a national level, we are to be a model to other nations, that you, as the president, have responsibility to God, right? And you, as an economist, have responsibility to God. And you, as a politician, in all the various levels. What has happened, unfortunately, today, is certain religious people want to stay away from politics. You know, because that's, you know, we'll just sit and learn Torah. But the whole point of it was to get involved with creating a mamlacha, creating a kingdom. And if you read the Bible, just read it. That's clearly what it is. Right? As it says in the beginning of Deuteronomy, I have given you these ordinances in order to be in this land as my people, in this land, as a people, as a nation, as an And this is something that is not clear for people, and therefore when you start talking about, you know, when you water down Judaism as some kind of way of your personal individual fulfillment, as if your individual fulfillment is somehow independent of your commitment to the nation, right? So then it doesn't matter where you do it, it doesn't matter, you know, and it's, you know, I could be a Jew keeping Shabbos in Hawaii, and I don't have to have a connection to any other Jews, right? Or a commitment to building my country, Eretz Yisrael. I don't need that. Right? I've got my God. That's not Judaism. That's not Judaism. Right? The Jew's relationship, unique relationship with God, is through the nation, right? As a nation. And the full term, and the full sense of what nationhood means. Right? When people couldn't care less about the nation, right? But care about the Torah, then they don't even know what the Torah is talking about. Right? When people make decisions that destroy the unity of our people, right? Because they care about the Torah. Right? then there's something very, very wrong in their understanding of the Torah was for the nation. Just read it simply. Right? What is it talking about? So as individuals, you know, there are many holy individuals in the world, but a chosen nation, Abraham was not chosen to be a holy individual. He was chosen to be the founding father and root of a holy nation that demonstrates that on a national level there exists a relationship and a responsibility to a God. Okay? Any other questions? Yeah.
Okay, if that's true, then isn't it kind of ironic that we seem to be one of the most divided nations in a way? And it says, Yahav Zareich Kamocha, you're supposed to love your neighbor as yourself, right? But there are so many people that are Jewish and, you know, let's say me personally, like, they're nice people and everything, but no connection whatsoever.
But what you just said is precisely the miracle. Divided, yes, but still a nation. That's the miracle. That's the miracle of the Jewish people. That's the miracle of having two Jews and three opinions. That yet we have had some very serious fallouts amongst ourselves, and yet we still walk around with buttons saying one people. And we're still one people. And when the crunch comes, we stick together. Right? And you can have a Jew on an island all by himself. And he tells you there are two synagogues on his island. And you say, what do you need two synagogues for? He says, one I go to and one I would never go to. Right? You gotta have two synagogues, right? It's a miracle. Because Jews have so much individuality and yet still maintained a national unity for thousands of years. Well, I mean, if that's not a nation, what is? Right. What is? That is the beauty, the strength of the national identity of that which binds us all, which is God. Right. And therefore, yeah, we've got a lot of problems, you know. Well, but problems are very often the way you grow.
So as far as relating to people one-on-one, if, let's say, I don't get along with somebody else who's Jewish, I should just love them for the fact that they're Jewish and respect them.
They're part of your nation. They're part of your nation. You have to understand that the word tzibur, right? Tzibur, which means a congregation, right? Tzibur actually is a hint to what makes a community, right? Because tzibur means tzaddik, right? Tzaddik is the righteous. Bet is the beinoni, which is the middle kind of guy, and Reish is the Russia, the evil. They all make the tzibur. And when you read the Bible, one of the first things that they talk about is setting up cities for people who have killed people unintentionally so that they can escape to the city. I mean, like, the Bible right away gets right into what it means to be a nation, which means you're going to have some criminals and you're going to have to deal with it. And that's a nation. And yet we're a chosen nation. We're talking about a chosen nation, and God addressing the chosen nation tells this chosen nation what they should do with people who murder, people who steal. Why would you have to say that to a chosen nation? Right? Because a chosen nation doesn't mean you're the greatest people in the world. A chosen nation means you are a nation that demonstrates how to struggle with identity as a function of responsibilities to a supreme being. Right. And that's what you've been chosen. You haven't been chosen to be perfect. What could you teach if you were perfect? Right. You're chosen to play out human identity and the particular struggles implicit in that identity when you care about a being beyond yourself. Right. That's chosen nature.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation. and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.